This is Ricky Simons, the voice of Gurr from Invader Zim, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Woo!
Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Em, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 66, 6 years later.
It is our 6th anniversary.
Yay.
So it's time for us to do our annual State of the Pod address, cover some feedback, and talk about an anniversary issue from all the way back in this year.
And spoilers, no audio drama this year.
So stop asking.
And probably no audio dramas ever again.
No one's asking.
All right. Annual State of the Pod address.
Run those numbers.
In the last 12 months, Relative the Geeky has produced 39 episodes, which is our lowest number ever.
Good.
Which we're pleased with. 40 last year, so we're in the same ballpark. Again, as we say every year, we never promised you a regular date and time. The expectation for shows like that put just way too much pressure on us.
It's a lot. It's a lot, guys.
We did talk about slowing our pace a little bit, just to make sure we could keep doing this for the long haul, however long that haul ends up being. And I think that's worked.
Yeah, we do about 3 episodes per month.
Land right around there. That's what we want to do. We did 18 quarter bins, 12 comics reading journals.
Hey, you managed to do a monthly show.
Hey, how about
Perfect.
That?
Perfect.
This is our 6th Short Box Showcase, and we did 3 Relatively Geeky Presents.
Point
I think
out.
A couple of those were Doctor Who related. From February. One more time. Last time.
Last time. And never again. Now, in defense of those Short Box Showcases, most of them were over 90 minutes.
That is true.
So if you average them out, it was more like 8 to 12.
And we did do 12 Dorkness to Light episodes. 7 of them were last October for Halloween times. So I'm just saying, if you want to hear more of the two of us together, that's the feed to listen to.
Don't unsubscribe from this one.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, slow and steady growth in subscribers, which is encouraging. Watchmen and Identity Crisis continue to get downloads.
As they always will.
Especially because listeners keep bringing them up. And people like DCOCD keep asking us on to talk about it. And of course, every episode of Uncovering the Bronze Age gets mega downloads as well. It's okay. I can handle it. I'm proud of you. But life rolls on, and in some very eerie ways, this summer is
a
weird
like last
carbon
summer.
Copy
weird.
Of last summer. A lot of folks know your mom had knee surgery.
Again?
Last year and again this year.
My roommate had brain surgery last year and this year.
I visited my father a couple times in North Carolina last year.
This year in Maryland.
This year. And we've actually had family. My father-in-law and brother-in-law, my wife's dad and brother, they've moved to town, and that has certainly changed our free time availabilities. And so, said it last year, sometimes our hobbies, even the ones we really enjoy, have to take back seats at times.
Not to, like, you know, harp on this constantly, but also I bought a house.
Yes.
So, like,
that happened since last year. That was October, November, right?
Yep. And am I going to have my housewarming before that 1 year anniversary date?
Maybe.
We shall see.
But in terms of announcements for things around here, I think we're sort of in the vibe of no news is good news. Just keep carrying on and doing
it. Keep on carrying on. Second verse, same as the first. I really, really like how much Dorkness to Light content we created this year. And, like, hey, you know, not to brag about the other show while we're here, but I am really proud of that show, and I am proud of the amount of time that you and I have sat down and dedicated to making it as good as possible.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to Short Box Showcase, which is just an afterthought for us now.
No.
Just kidding. So, not much of a state of the pod, because there's not much change in the state of our pods. So, Let's move on to the feedback section of the episode. First, a quick shout out to Tom Panarese, who on a recent episode of Pop Culture Affidavit said some very nice things about your Uncovering the Bronze Age episode about the Comics Code and Dr. Frederick Wortham. He called it one of the best single podcast episodes he's ever heard, as a matter of fact.
And I am very glad that everybody likes that so much, because it is the episode that killed Uncovering the Bronze Age, because I did that and said, wow, I am never going to ever do anything that good ever again on this feed. And then I covered GLGA, and I was out.
Boom. Mic drop.
You know, sometimes you've only got 6 episodes in you.
Yeah, there you go.
Sometimes cool. One of them is like the best piece of writing and research that you'll ever produce. And sometimes you do that when you're like 22 and then you have to live with that. It's fine.
No, it's fine.
It's no pressure.
It's okay. We still like you.
It's cool.
Now, I recently tweeted a picture of the Spectre's eyes peering out from the handle holes in one of your short boxes, which was intentional, of course, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I said something on the lines of, sure, you could borrow one of M's comics, but if you don't return it or if you file it wrong, you may face some wrath.
Excuse you. Judgment.
And hearkening back to a long ago episode wherein he earned his nickname, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, replied to that with, what do you mean by file?
And to carry on with the in-jokes and references, fellow library staff member Mark Sweeney from the Rhode Island School of Design made a shocking admission, which is that our triennial inventory makes one thing clear. We can't keep our own complicated cataloging straight.
I knew it!
That's got to be just a thing, right? Like the summer search and weed. Like if you work in academia, that's just a thing that happens. Because I've been boxing old, falling apart, discarded, replaced, outdated books for like 6.5 weeks.
It's funny because I was recently talking with one of your former colleagues from when you worked at the public library. And of course, in the public library world, summer is the craziest time because of kids' summer reading programs.
Yes.
And in academia, it's project time because there's not much happening. It's like the exact opposite.
Yes.
Summers are the exact opposite in the public and academic library world. And hearkening back to a prior episode, our Doctor Who Gallifrey One chat, Derek from the Fan Holes podcast had this brief comment. Thanks for sharing this one. It was a lot of fun.
And then related to the general topic of cons, we heard from our buddy Carla, who reported that Wizard World had returned to her area in Pittsburgh.
Yay!
I about had a total meltdown.
That's our Carla.
Yeah, it is. This I could never have predicted, because the last con in the area was in 2016, long before my journey into DC. From everything I'd heard, it didn't perform nearly as well as they'd hoped, and I figured they were never coming back. Never say never, I guess. And it's the weekend leading up to my birthday in July, which is also amazing.
Perfect.
No idea who will be appearing yet, but I'm hoping for a good lineup. But no matter what, I am excited, and I'm going to go and support it, because as far as I know, it may never happen again.
Now, Pittsburgh is about 150 miles from us, so if they announce that Matt Ryan will be appearing, we will hear it. I mean, literally, we'll hear Carla's squee.
We will audibly hear it from Pittsburgh, absolutely. The squee heard round the world. Carla also said that she took a recent trip to New York City, which was great, but Professor Allen, steam would blow out your ears like a Tex Avery cartoon if you saw what I spent on comics and manga.
Oh my.
I couldn't find a single quarter bin in the city. But I was able to track down some trades of both New 52 Dead Man and Hawk and Dove. Besides John and Z, I really love Dove and Dead Man, especially post-Brightest Day.
That's reasonable.
Now, it is quite grimdark, but the characterization of Dove in Titans is excellent. So I'm really hoping that Carla either, you know, at some point has signed up for the 7-day free trial or something like that, but has managed to hop on there and check out the Dove-centric episodes because they're both amazing.
Excellent. That's what I've heard.
She closes out her letter by saying, "By the way, I've been a listener for almost 2 years, and every episode gets better and better. Thanks for kindly listening and responding to my feedback. God bless and take care, Carla."
On both the Small Press Con and Spidey Talk episodes, Listener of the Year Nathaniel Wayne had a few things to say.
I'm shocked.
"Dearest Middletons, I actually agree with M."
Yes.
Wait, did I misread that opening?
I know, right?
"I actually agree with them that the first Spider-Man is overrated, but I also understand why. First, it's got an amazing sequel that still stands up, which required the groundwork that was laid in that first film. So it gets some benefit of the doubt in hindsight.
That's fair. Certainly fair. I think Spider-Man 2 and Amazing Spider-Man 1 are about on par. Mm-hmm. I quite like Amazing Spider-Man. I know that not everyone agrees with that.
He says that it also deserves recognition, this is the first Spider-Man, for basically proving that comic accurate and absurd was viable. Because up until that point, most comic book movies had gone out of their way to not look comic booky. That first X-Men and the yellow spandex line pretty much embodying the thinking of the time.
Yeah, it was not a great time.
Something needed to prove that the source material didn't have to be toned down for the masses before we could get things like the MCU or Aquaman or Shazam or any of the better superhero films of the last decade, and Spider-Man 1 did just that. However, it should be noted that being important isn't the same as being good, and I think people's failure to make that distinction is a big part of why this is overpraised in many circles. They may have stated it more harshly than I would, but M and I are on the same page. That said, Green Lantern deserves no boosting.
Okay, there it is.
If it had come out around the same time as Spider-Man, maybe, but 9 years later?
Yeah.
3 years after Iron Man and Dark Knight, nobody has any excuse for cranking out an early 2000s movie at that point in time. Even if they weren't imitating those previously mentioned game changers, any studio worth their salt should have realized that playing by the old rules wasn't going to work. As for the con you attended, that sounded like quite a lovely time indeed. I'm really making a concerted effort these days to try to get to more events of any kind. I don't have enough physical merch of my own for a Council of Geeks.
There's that obligatory plug.
To have it be worth getting a booth yet. But I'd like to get out to these things more and try networking the old-fashioned way, since the newfangled technological networking is something I seem to lack the knack for. Vermont Comic-Con recently folded, and these sorts of things won't really hold much interest for my daughter, so if it's during my time with her, that's probably out too. But later this year, I'll be going to Terrificon with my partner Liz. And yes, as you mentioned, I'll be at Gallifrey 1 next year. Hopefully this is the start of more regularly doing these sorts of things, but only time will tell. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne.
And as always, the invitation is outstanding. If you wind up in the central Midwest,
let us know.
Hit us up. We'll take you to Hotheads. Dr. Ange also commented about these smaller cons. Up here they have, I'm going to say, MIC Expo, or possibly Mice Expo, or McExpo. Either way, it is the Massachusetts Independent Comic Expo. I do my best to attend and support the arts as best as possible. I find these to be a lot of fun. I'm glad you went and talked to these folks and used your forum to promote their work.
Yeah, like I said, not everything was necessarily to my taste. But yes, I think of it as being a patron to these young, and sometimes not so young, artists.
Also, you did find the greatest mini-comic of all time, which is my dumb, spiteful hedgehog, which I reread about once a week.
Now, in terms of getting into our last episode, where we talked about criticism and reviews and terminology, we're going to cover some of that feedback here. And we've done this before, so we're going to start with feedback from me.
This is our
mea culpa section.
Our mea culpa retractions and corrections section.
We do have to address one point that was kindly and lovingly pointed out by a couple of our polite and kind listeners. The woman who was fridged in Green Lantern was not Jade, who did in fact die later in the Rand-Thanagar War. The woman who was fridged was Kyle's girlfriend, Alex. Now, in my defense, one, you were on a heck of a roll, and if you thought I was going to interrupt you for a second, no.
If you thought we were going to have a pause for fact-checking.
And two, to be fair, Kyle Rayner has had about a billion girlfriends, so it's kind of hard to keep him straight.
Yeah. Which, let's just say, is a different problem.
And my favorite part about this is that all of the male listeners who wrote in to correct this all addressed me because I think they didn't want to get accused of mansplaining after the episode. They all were very kind and gentle. So, you know, I think possibly
actually,
I have misspoken and thought...
Yes, which is appreciated, and thank you all very much for reaching out and correcting, mostly me. Yes, that is not the same woman.
And you had a thing to say.
Yes, I also have a combination retraction and significantly belatedly realized I completely missed a major point that I wanted to make in that episode. Part of this I'm going to blame on my own bad note-taking, especially for long episodes like that where I definitely never prep enough. And part of it I'm going to blame on the fact
that the length of the episode.
The episode was 127 minutes or something by the time we were done. And by the time we were recording this, it was minute 200. I was very tired. I had to go to work. So I basically glanced at my notes and threw some things at the end real quick and did not give them any of the context or discussion that I originally intended to. At the end of our discussion about fridging, I talked about a couple examples of characters who I felt had been really badly mistreated. One of them, Leon Harper, I made the case that even though she was not killed maybe with the same brutality or sexualization of that violence, the way that other characters who are fridged are, that because she was a child, that aspect made it a more brutal action, and as a result, made that qualify for fridging. A few moments later, I talked about a different situation in Identity Crisis. And when I re-listened to the episode after it had already gone out to print,
whoops,
realized I only made half of my closing point. I talked about Jack Drake and how pointless his death was, how upset I was, how little sense it made, and how really upset I was by it. And I very, very, very briefly mentioned a change of topic in between those two things. Of saying that, yes, although this only hits, we had been talking about the three requirements,
right,
that this only hit two, I was very upset about it. And I talked at great length about how bothered I was by its inclusion. This was originally to make a point about structural problems with fridging. I also had a second aspect to talk about with the treatment of female characters, which I realized I completely left off my list. I forgot to talk about the most mistreated female character in Identity Crisis, which is in and of itself a problem.
And that's Jean.
And that's Jean. If you're talking about fridging as a shorthand for violence against women, then absolutely the brutal, horrible death of Sue Dibney is absolutely something which should be brought up. We made our own case as to why we didn't think that it fit the definition of fridging largely because as an inciting incident for the story, it was actually given the emotional weight that it deserved. A character who is extremely mistreated by this story and whose narrative is absolutely sacrificed purely to motivate a male character is not actually a main character at all. It's Jean Loring, who is revealed to be the murderer at the end of the story, and the fact that she killed her best friend is not the big reveal. That is not the thing that is given the time to examine. She does not have any sort of space to express how badly that tortured her, how sorry she is, how pained she is by killing one of her best friends. That's not what's given page time. What's given page time is how hurt her husband is by this. The person who's really suffering in this situation is not the woman who accidentally killed one of her best friends. It's her husband who's horrified by her actions.
Wow.
And her murder of Sue, that action is not examined except in how it relates to her husband.
Yeah.
Her being revealed as the actual person who did this horrible thing is not giving any sort of narrative weight for her character.
It's all in the context of what this does for Ray and his relations and his career and... Wow.
So that is the woman most mistreated by the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to make that sort of distinction that there is this terrible trend towards brutalization and victimization of women in comic books. There is also this horrible trend of not letting female characters carry their own emotional and narrative weight.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when you put the two things together, you get fridging. So at the end of that section, the plan was to take those two apart, to talk about them, put them back together, and then end the episode. But it was minute 200, and I, like the writers, forgot to give any weight to Jean Loring's inclusion in this discussion. So, a retraction, correction, and addendum to add on to that episode. Mea culpa.
Very good. Very good. Well, our good friend, podcasting's Michael Bailey, had some things to say about last episode as well. I kind of wish that you two would have ended that disclaimer at the beginning of that episode with, and if you feel that we've maybe hit a little too close to home with our commentary, it's not personal, but you may want to take a good long look in the mirror, loser.
Now, first of all, he didn't say loser.
I added that for emphasis.
And secondly, we do not ascribe to the boot fits, lace it up mentality on this podcast.
He ends with, oh, the things that amuse me.
And we think this may have also been a Bailey note, and if not, we're already apologizing.
It certainly sounds like it, but I lost the actual notation.
On that episode, when I was explaining the differences between various iterations of canon and headcanon, I said that Elliot Spencer from Leverage and Jake Stone from The Librarians being cousins was a headcanon. And Michael's reaction was to say out loud in the car, of course, this is settled law. And that right there is the perfect example of fan canon. Because I had a headcanon, he had a headcanon, we realized it was the same headcanon, cue the Barack Obama gif, it is law.
He did explain the way the crossover would work?
Oh yeah, and it's the easiest thing in the world. Just
a woman comes to the Leverage crew because a family heirloom is stolen and no one will help.
And then it turns out it's some magical hoo-ha and the librarians show up and everybody collectively saves the day. And at least at one point, Jake and Elliot have to like switch places and it's
hilarity
hysterical.
Would ensue. That was probably Mike, may have been Andy Leyland, may have been someone else. Whoever's idea that was, bonus points for you as a listener.
And to cap off our fandom discussion, Archive of Our Own is an incredible resource funded by and for fans, and you should go support them. And there are many, 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 many leverage librarian crossover fix.
Clinton Robinson from Coffee and Comics said he enjoyed the episode, despite the feeling of being thrown back to his thesis days.
Excellent.
Now, he and I were texting back and forth as he listened. It was not live tweeting, but it was live texting to me.
It's live adding, basically.
And here are a few selected bits to that. I'm nearly 45 minutes in and beginning to realize that somewhere after the 1 hour mark, the professor will just be relegated to, yes, I agree, and wow, Em, I wasn't aware of that. This is probably the smartest move. Why would one try to stop a moving train?
I am something of the unstoppable force once I get going on theory.
On one of the many topics we covered, he added, I understand many, and I do mean many, of the movies I enjoy are bad movies. Doesn't stop me from watching Masters of the Universe, Bloodsport, or tons of others every time they're on TV. Much like good versus enjoyable, one has to have the ability to discern between socially acceptable and enjoyable, i.e. Tarzan, Conan, etc. He also passed on this message from an interested third party.
Dear Alan and M, total bunk? Who raised you, M? Such language. Alan, you're doing just fine. Reserved and poised at all times. Sincerely, the podcast police. You know, Nathaniel Wayne may not have very much merch, but if he pooled all of his merch and we made some shirts that said total bunk.
I'm just saying.
Could we
maybe
split a booth at some point? Just throwing out options.
I'm just saying. Clinton also shared this take on fan canon and the situation when creators pay too much attention to it. I have my own arguments on when authors or showrunners, etc., allow fanon to become canon simply to bring in better ratings. If it serves the interest of the story, then that's fine. But just because there's a massive online interest in Concept A doesn't mean it will be good for the franchise. He also appreciated our stand on what is and isn't fridging, as well as taking on the common misuses of Mary Sue.
That really is like our co-soapbox. Like,
yeah. And Clinton closed with, I can officially say I have attended lectures on similar topics that were much less entertaining and much less informative. So kudos.
Awesome. Sean Urbanski said that it was a great episode and also gave his thoughts on two of those topics. Regarding the stereotypical, there is the Twilight Zone episode, A World of His Own, which is quite worth checking out, and about authorial intent. In the movie Back to School, Rodney Dangerfield's character hires Kurt Vonnegut to write his term paper for him. A term paper on Kurt Vonnegut. You know, speaking of Death of the Author, because Good Omens has come out since we recorded this, Neil Gaiman, on the one hand, is enduring far too much from various camps of entitled and insufferable fans. And for this, I am eternally apologizing. Just, I am so sorry, Mr. Gaiman. Just let that man write a book. It's all he wants.
Isn't insufferable fans a bit redundant? Just asking.
Listen. Just because you're right doesn't mean you can say it on the internet.
Sorry.
But he has, I think, it's literally the anti-JK Rowling Twitter. He has the best understanding of authorial intent and the boundaries of author ownership of any writer currently living. Because people tweet him all the time and go, hey, here's my headcanon. He goes, awesome. Hey, here's my completely contradictory headcanon. Awesome. Or even people will get like really, really persistent about this specific thing. What happened here?
What did he mean? What was the purpose?
What was the purpose of that? What was the intention behind this? And he literally has a whole essay written up that he just sends people when they do that. And he just says, I did my job. I wrote my story. A couple years later, the networks were so kind as to bring me back to make fan fiction of my own show. Anything that I have to say on Twitter, in a book, in the Good Omens official companion, is not canon. Mm-hmm. The only canon is the text and your eyes on the text. End. I'm like, man, he's a legend.
That's a good way to go about creating. I kind of like the way Robert Kirkman handled the Walking Dead TV show, because he literally took it as an opportunity to very specifically take different branches, to take different forks in the road and say, you know, what if this character had lived and this one had died? Instead, where would that have taken the story?
Yeah.
So he's taking it as some type of fan fiction approach as well. He's not calling it that, not as straightforward as Gaiman is, but that's in essence what he's doing too. He's playing in the author's sandbox, just that he was the original author also.
Yeah. But no one is more canon than the other.
Exactly.
They're just different.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just wanted to take a moment and say Good Omens is amazing. Neil Gaiman is a legend and a treasure, and I love and respect him so very much. I can only hope that I will be so lucky as to one day meet him.
Now, we do have more detailed and particular feedback on some of the things that we said in that episode. We just wanted to cover some of the shorter and, frankly, some of the lighter things here in this episode. So we're going to do a full revisit of that topic again. And some of the issues of identity crisis, because
every time we think we're out, it just pulls us right back in. I'm going to take a tally. I'm going to figure out how many minutes of our podcast we've spent talking about identity crisis, because it's got to be in like the upper 400s. We've done at least like 4 or 5 episodes that are at least in some part about identity crisis. And I will never get tired of talking about it.
Nope.
But we've talked about it a lot.
So if you sent feedback of that nature, longer and more in-depth feedback about that, it will be addressed probably in next episode.
When we'll have more space to give it the sort of time and thought that it deserves. And, full disclosure, when we're not recording at 10:15 at night.
So for now, we're going to take a break and come back and talk about a comic that is celebrating, like us, a very big anniversary.
Well, hi there. This is Huckleberry Ham. And when I'm not busy making movies or TV shows, I enjoy listening to my favorite internet radio show, Two True Freaks. They got all sorts of shows for y'all to listen to, covering all sorts of geeky topics. Star Trek, Star Wars, cartoons, scary movies, folks eating supper, music, giant monsters, and one feller who buys stuff at garage sales. And the funny books. My word, the funny books. Old funny books. New funny books. Scary funny books. Movies about funny books. Funny books about movies. British fellers talking about funny books. And lots more. So why don't you check these fellers out? Head on over to twotruefreaks.com and tell them Huckleberry sent you. Two True Freaks, chock full of great podcasts since 2008.
And we're back.
Now, before we get to our anniversary book, I have an announcement to make.
What?
And a related listener request. As I've talked about on, I think, the Comics Reading Journal, maybe the Quarter of Ben, but I don't think here. It turns out that there is another person on my campus who's not just a podcaster, but he podcasts about comic books. Nerds.
It's a small world after all.
So, and that is Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, and also from the office around the corner and down the hall from me. And over the summer, we decided to attempt on our campus to start a comic book club.
Yes!
And so we've kicked around some ideas of what we're going to do. We're drawing the geek line at gaming.
Yeah, it's not a gaming club. No board games, no video games, none of that.
We do think we have to include...
No card games.
We have to include anime and manga just to potentially get students interested.
Yes.
to come to the club.
But, you know, comics and manga, cartoons and anime. 1, 2, 3, 4.
TV and movies about those things as well.
Yes.
That's the line.
I think those are some good parameters.
And actually what I wanted to ask listeners was, well, if you were lucky enough to have that geeky a club when you were in school, or wished you had, what are some of the things we could do or talk about? We do have a student who is big into amateur do-it-yourself cosplay, so we have a meeting.
Good.
On the agenda for that.
A presentation.
Exactly. So we didn't know, just sort of, you know, throw us some ideas of what are some of the things a club like this, mostly in terms of the regular meetings. We actually have a couple of bigger picture ideas. We think maybe during exams week, we could, if we can get a classroom or get a location, sort of have the relaxation decompression room with some Batman animated series or Super Friends episode showing, or something that you can, a 20-minute episode of something between exams or after your exam, or while you're waiting for your buddy to get out of their exam so you could drive home. Sort of a fun and relaxation area that you mentioned.
Yeah. Now, I love this idea. This is great. My suggestion was that you need to go talk to your library, because in my case, I work for a residential campus and you work for a regional campus.
Right.
So in your case, you guys don't have dorms, so you don't have like RAs and student associations and weekend event planning and stuff like that that goes on at someplace more like my workplace. Mm-hmm. But I said that you should definitely check in with the library, because at least for us, we always try and plan some sort of treats during exam week, or a fun prize, or invite our gaming club to bring some video game systems and set up in the basement, things like that. And so either they already have a plan, or if they don't have a plan, they might have a space.
Right, or they might know of a club that does a similar type thing that we could at least co-join with, co-sponsor, something like that.
Right.
The other thing I think we're going to do is do a collect comics event as a charity drive sort of giveaway.
I
know
like
of at least three organizations that I've sent comics to at various times as donations. Sort of let the club vote on which of those they want to support for Christmas or at the end of the year,
now,
and then collect comics and mail them off.
We
have no budget. I just thought I'd say that. We have no budget. So, send everyone to Comic-Con or to... No.
Buy group passes for Wizard World. That's not going to happen. I have an idea.
Field trip might be to the used bookstore.
Yes. You have a good one.
I have a good one.
There's a good one in town. Ooh, how about this for an idea? So if you do end up doing some sort of fundraiser...
Right.
I would suggest getting the club to table, you know, set up in a hallway somewhere on campus with boxes. That is, give us your used paperbacks. Or if you do own physical comics or manga.
Sci-fi magazines, old stuff, right?
Yeah, stuff like that. And be like, you can donate your used books, because students often do want to get rid of their used books. They usually try and sell them back to the bookstore, but a lot of places won't take them because they're in beat-up condition.
We can donate them or trade them, sell them ourselves.
Exactly.
Trade them for comics.
And possibly then have, because this is the thing that sometimes places do at like coffee shops or whatever, have little tip jars. Again, students don't really carry cash that often, but you never know. And have a little thing that's like, if you want to donate to one of these causes, and have your Comics for the Troops, Comics Corps of Canada, something like that, have a couple mason jars. Be like, you can use your spare change to vote for where you want us to give the books. And then also be collecting a little bit of petty cash to cover the shipping,
that. Okay, I like it.
We're trying to do a zero sum. We need to at least cover the shipping to Canada.
Exactly. So feel free to email, Twitter me, Message me on Facebook if something jumps out at you as something that has to be done or has to be covered. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a comic book club, you have to do this.
Or the thing something that you always hated.
Oh, to draw the thing to avoid.
Are there big pitfalls or are there big things that might get overlooked that are really important?
Exactly. Well, thank you in advance for that support. And I will report back. Ooh, next anniversary episode. You can report back on
you tell us
the first year of
three semesters.
Comic book
see
club.
How it goes.
Well, that does bring us to our big sixth anniversary with a comic that is, you know, celebrating a very similar type of anniversary. If you think about it, in the big picture of things, six and 80 years, in terms of, you know, life of the universe, it's pretty much rounds to the same thing.
Just about. You know, 66 episodes, 1,000 issues.
Same thing. This is, of course, Detective Comics 1000. You can think of this as a follow-up to Short Box Showcase 14.
Oh, that's true, because we did Detective 27 back in 2014.
So here we go. First Batman,
Don't put that out there.
So, first off, we have to talk about the covers. Now, of course, there were a million covers by the time they ended, but they had the core decade covers. And I chose for us the 60s Jim Steranko cover. But you flipped through these, and which one sort of jumped out to you?
Well, surprising no one, I loved the 90s comic. It's very much styled in the Paul Dini Red Sky animated series.
This is the Tim Sale one.
Yes, the one by Tim Sale. And it's that is my Batman. Like, when you look at it, that glowery with the white slit on the mask, red background with the red moon in the sky. Like, that's Batman.
I get that.
In my mind. But I will give a shout out and say that my second favorite comic was the zany 50s Batman adventure, psychic Batman, Martian Batman, baby Batman, old man Batman, Scottish Batman,
Rainbow Batman, alien Batman. Don't forget Robot Batman.
And Robot Batman, Scuba Batman.
Little Kid Batman. Raja Swami Turban Batman.
I don't know.
Look,
a lot of mistakes were made in the 50s.
I'm just saying. I like Iron Knight. I don't know, Batman. Pink Tuxedo Batman.
Well, we can't skip Giant Batman or professional caveman wrestler Batman. It's just zany, and it's very well drawn. It's definitely in the style of The Brave and the Bold. Comic series,
yeah, that's
or
the
Frank, cartoon series.
Yeah, that's the Frank Cho one. For some reason, it was too wacky. Could not too bring wacky myself.
For you.
I know. I think it may have been Mummy Batman that just put me over the edge and said, "No, I need a classic."
Look, all of those Batmans, the only one that I actually approve of is, in fact, Mummy Batman.
You know, like old man Batman and original OG Batman?
I did miss Scottish Batman, and I do love him a lot.
So I went with the purple sky, purple background, purple everything.
That's a lot of
Jim
purple,
Steranko,
dude.
And there's not enough green there to offset it. So I get that. I like the simplicity of it. Obviously, Mr. Steranko has a background or interest in, like, magic and escape artists, so that's sort of the... It's the upside down swinging, looks a little like a, you know, Houdini pose, so you can see where that's going from. This is a very slim and slender and gymnastic.
Which I do appreciate, because there is a Frank Miller Batman on this list. Of course, there has to be.
Whoa.
And it just underlined how much I hate short square Batman. It's not good. It's just not good.
Well, then. You know, remember when Action 1000 came out, which I don't think we actually ever officially talked about on a podcast somewhere, but we ended up with two different.
Yeah, we each bought one.
For one, there were so many ones that we dubbed. But this one, We went. I made the family. I put my family parental foot down.
You bought the Jim Steranko. Oh no! How terrible. You know, this was a $10 special,
yeah,
which is a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I find it for $7.
That 50s? Are you looking for that 50s
one? I would gladly spend $7 on either the 50s cover or the 90s cover. Yeah. So if I see either one of those popping up at Half Price Books or in the, you know, the discount area, the slight discount, you know, back issue section of our comic store, I might pick up a second copy.
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of good things that came out in the 90s, including you.
Ah!
See what I did there?
Love it.
No wonder you're a little biased. I actually got the one the decade I was born too. Wow.
It's almost
so weird.
You know, it's almost like with Batman. It's really easy to read a lot of nostalgia into this character.
I just thought of that about 45 seconds ago.
Hmm.
Wow.
Interesting.
Weird. Our favorites.
Well, you know what? We're going to be looking at all of the various stories presented in these. Having all new material, they still do a really good job of covering the range of early Batman, postmodern Batman, living in Tibet Batman, street crime Batman,
they
funny
covered a
Batman,
lot.
Serious Batman. So.
I think that actually Action 1000 did a little bit better in terms of eras of Superman.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
But I think this one hit a lot of the different takes on Batman, different versions of Batman over the years.
And it's true because, honestly, almost when it comes to Batman, every creator almost has their own version of Batman.
There almost is, yeah.
Like with Superman, 30s Superman is a very specific beast, and 50s Superman is a very specific type of thing, and 90s Superman is very specific. And I don't think there was actually really ever been that kind of uniformity with Batman.
Whoever the creator is at the time, whoever's on Batman or Detective, they sort of set their tone almost, it seems like.
Yeah.
And then you throw in Brave and the Bold and Bob Haney and some of the other Justice Leagues and World's Finest, all the other places where Batman is appearing over the broad sweep of DC Comics. There are lots of different Batmans.
Yeah, so that's not necessarily a criticism per se, because it's actually quite reflective of Detective Comics.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is definitely kind of feels like a grab bag.
Right. Now, we do start with a detective story, which I'm glad we did get. We start with Batman's Longest Case by Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo, and Jonathan Klepion, in which Batman follows clues for decades and finds a very secret society. One that includes both Slam Bradley and Detective Chimp. Boom, it's the Detectives Club.
That's a really solid opener.
That was a fun way to start. Yes, that was a fun opener.
I know that you love this because it has Detective Chimp.
Yes!
I love it because it has Ralph Dibny.
See, for me, I wasn't sure this was actually a DC book.
Right.
But then we got the Talking Monkey, and I felt comfortable. Okay, I know where I am now. I'm in the warm embrace of DC Comics, because there's a Talking Monkey. Yes.
Excellent. You have come home at last. Yes, this is truly a celebration of Batman in that it involves talking animals. I liked this story. The twist was solid, but, you know, I thought this was like a solid good opener.
Right.
I was a little confused as to why Kendra, because that is this particular version of Hawk Girl, and Sue Dibny were in the club, which I was just a little confused.
Kendra
on those.
And Katar.
Were they
both
detectives?
They're both in this
cops.
Version. They are.
So like that I can give a little bit of a pass. I was a little sad that Batwoman was not here.
Right. Maybe at least the Detective Montoya version of the question.
See, that would have been great
instead of
the classic. But, you know.
Yeah, the Devic. Here's the thing, though. I'm not going to go full shag, but on the splash page, Sue is so adorable.
She is so precious.
She is so cute.
Oh my gosh.
So.
And especially because time, especially in like these sorts of one-off what if kind of stories, is so weird. She and Ralph are so young.
Yes.
And I feel so sad looking at them. But I love them and I am glad that they were here. So.
Yes, it is. We do want representation.
Mm-hmm.
We do want diversity. you've talked about tokenism before, and this may have bent a little bit in that direction.
Yeah, maybe it would have been nice if there were some actual female detectives in the club, not just people's wives and girlfriends, but...
I get you. I do have to give a shout out to Bobo again, because if you're not reading the current Justice League Dark, and I've looked at the sales figures, you're probably not.
We're the only ones. It's fine.
But this is the team led by Wonder Woman, and Detective Chimp is part of that team. He actually plays sort of an integral role in some of the storylines, and it is dark for him. He's had some rough times leading into book. So,
oh no, poor Bobo.
Because you might think, why is Bobo in the Justice League Dark with all the magic users? That's all I'm saying. Well worth reading. And don't worry, soon you'll be able to find them cheap.
Can we just have a book we love have decent sales figures literally ever? So if Bobo was definitely far and away the highlight of the first story, the second story, Manufacture for Use, written by Kevin Smith with Jim Lee and Scott Williams on art, focuses on Matches Malone.
Yes.
I loved this story. This really? One was definitely good. In my sort of my upper tier. It is a really well thought out concept of a story. The premise being that Matches Malone is in Gotham looking to buy a crime souvenir. Mm-hmm. And just the concept, the way this fleshes out sort of like the criminal underbelly and building on like the notoriety and fandom of Batman with this idea that either really rich collectors or professional criminals and sort of seedy, sleazy people, like this particular iteration of Matches, would collect these sorts of weird bits and pieces, like parts of Batman's costume or like one of the hats that got left behind mm-hmm. by the Mad Hatter. These little bits and pieces of the detritus of the crime industry in Gotham has like its own black market, I think is fascinating. Like mm-hmm. conceptually, I love that.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
Not just as a late 20-something, mm-hmm. but just also as yourself. Experiences, thoughts about Kevin Smith? Maybe for the generation above you, late 30s into the 40s, he was huge.
Yeah. I personally don't have strong opinions about Kevin Smith, but I do like him. Mm-hmm. He sort of falls into the same category of Joss Whedon in my mind, but better. In Joss Whedon's case, I very much think of him as, like, he's a guy who was very influential, but I'm not interested in him anymore, and he has very little left to say. Kevin Smith, I recognize, was, like, the most influential dude.
In terms of geekness to pop culture, so that popularity, I mean, like, or that intersection.
I will say this, I've never seen Clerks.
Yep.
Like, that wasn't part of my geek education coming up. That was not as integral to my geekness, but I recognize that it's very good. I recognize that, especially for like a specific time capsule, like how awesome it is, like how cool it is as an independent film, as his first film, as a send out to this very specific experience of geekness in like the late 80s and early 90s. I think that he is a cool dude who has interesting things to say, but who I run into like surprisingly infrequently.
Right. I get that.
But when he does pop up, I'm always, like, sort of pleasantly surprised. It's like, oh, Kevin Smith. Oh, right, yeah, I know he's good. And then, so I really enjoyed this story. I think that the ending, when he wanders away from what I think is really his strength, which is dialogue and character dialogue specifically, I think when he wanders off on the last couple of pages where it's more monologuing, he gets kind of lost. But conceptually, I love this story, and I think he pulled it off really well.
For a little while, I listened to the Smodcast that and Scott Mosier did, and I assume still do, as many years ago. I will say, one of the best single episodes of a podcast was the one they did, must have been Sunday night or a Monday morning, of the weekend where his movie Zack and Miri came out and totally bombed.
Ooh.
It is raw and ugly and crying and awesome. It is true confessions and shock and disappointment, and it's pretty stunning, actually, because, you know, he is willing to be himself. Mm-hmm. He's willing to be vulnerable. You never sense that there's a front being put up with him, and I think that's certainly commendable.
I will say this about Kevin Smith, and this goes for both auteurs and for geek people, like people right. that are like famous for being geeks. It's very easy to get caught up in your own shit.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about Kevin Smith is that his fame and notoriety and success and failure, none of it has actually seemed to impact him on a personal level.
Yeah.
That he still seems
doesn't
like the
seem
same.
To have changed him. Yeah.
He's the same very genuine, open, kind of vaguely awkward person mm-hmm. that he was before.
Right.
He became like famous as Kevin Smith.
I think that's true.
And I really appreciate that he always strikes me as a very genuine person.
Right.
And that is both as a person and as an artist. The most important thing right. to hold on to. Even if the stuff you make is mediocre, make it honestly.
Then we move to one of my favorites.
Okay.
Because in 100 pages, you need 6 pages of funny. Especially 100 pages of Batman. This might be your bright, shining moment. This is The Legend of Newt Brody by Paul Dini, Dustin Nguyen, and Derek Fridolfs.
Okay. It is really hard to beat that team. Like, yeah. I love Mr. Smith, and I respect
right?
him, and I enjoyed
Paul
the last
Dini
story.
Paul Dini and Dustin Nguyen.
I'm gonna be honest. My opinion of his story suffers by being immediately
right.
before
yeah.
the Paul Dini story, because this one is, like, top tier, like, perfection.
This is the biography of the worst henchman ever.
I love this.
With a great twist ending.
And it's got a great twist.
It starts with a premise that we've all thought in our head somewhere. Like, where do they get the henchmen from? Where do they get guys willing to wear matching costumes?
Dormouser, dressed like Humpty Dumpty to, like, go with your theme
but
and get beat up by Batman.
But it's got to be, like, the same pool of guys. They must, you know, when Riddler gets thrown in prison, his henchmen, they don't wait around for him to get out. They become Clock Kings. Henchmen, they move over to the Joker. Well, and a life expectancy on
that
one
pretty,
might not
be
so hot. Maybe a little Clayface action, but you know, there has to be a hench people are us. Something.
Henching is a gig economy. The concept of talking about henchmen, I always love. Not to shout out to the McElroys in literally every episode of everything ever, but I read War of the Realms. They're Marvel comic. And one of the things that happens on the road trip, that is the framing story of that little mini series, is that they go to a hench people convention, which is hysterical. That everybody else, like all of the actual villains, are all involved in the crossover. They're all
yes.
fighting the Norse gods who are like Hela and various other forces of chaos are like trying to destroy the world. And so all of the hench people have time off because all of their bosses are involved in something
exactly.
that's way above their pay grade. None of them are involved in the actual big bad action. So they all go and have a convention.
Chilling. They're just chilling, trying to get, you know, you got to set up a table with your business cards, with your resume.
Literally. There are panels that are being presented by
yes.
various people, but they've got like one or two kind of like low tier villains who used to be hench people who are like the keynote speakers who were like tough enough to be above hench level, but not tough enough
exactly.
to be involved in the big climactic Armageddon battle.
I mean, so it would seem to me in that industry, health coverage has really got to be the number one concern of the union.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, dental
big
one's is
dental.
The main one, but still.
And you know who did not pay into that? Newt Brody. Because my God, that man's face is a horror show.
And a twist ending and funny. And all of the villains hate him with, as it turns out...
Good reason.
Good reason. That's all we'll say.
This story is great. It's Paul Dini at his best, and it's probably the best of structured
yeah.
of the stories
right.
as far as, like, setup, explanation, payoff, punchline.
Yeah.
Artistically, it's beautiful. The way that the panels are even, like, laid out, it is, like, impeccable. It is an impeccable example of telling a short story very quickly but very effectively, and it's just fantastic. It's pretty, pretty hard to beat Paul Dini at his best.
Then we get the Batman's design by a pretty impressive team as well, Warren Ellis and Becky Cloonan. It is Batman as the crazy planner prepared for every contingency.
As you said, this is a great team. The art is beautiful. The writing is excellent, obviously.
The writing is very sparse. It's a couple of narration boxes.
And like one word or thought balloon every panel.
Yeah, that's about it.
But it's very effective.
Yes.
This is personally not really my taste. It is definitely more the grim, dark Batman. I mean, it's Warren Ellis.
Yep.
Warren Ellis is someone who I can recognize is very good. But again, just not really my thing.
But from an editing perspective, putting this one right after the funny one.
Oh, yeah.
This is the place to put it.
Definitely.
This is the place to put this one.
Definitely works as sort of like a palate cleanser. Mm-hmm. To go from, all right, you had your like one bright, like super funny, lighthearted story.
Back
and
down to
now,
hell.
Now we're going to get dragged down pretty deep so that then you can sort of move forward from here. The wrap up comes pretty fast.
Yeah.
I think this is not the best paced story. I think
right.
a lot of these writers, especially sort of like Warren Ellis, the next writer that we're going to talk about, or the next couple writers actually, aren't as comfortable with the little short story.
Yeah, it.
So some of these stories end pretty abruptly.
It's definitely a form that modern writers are not used to.
Yes.
Because even the backup story seems to...
Mostly gone.
Seems mostly gone, yeah. So everyone's looking at a 132-page...
Yeah.
six-issue story. Not a 8-to-10-page story.
Right. And so some of them, I think... The pacing
beginning
is a little,
good, middle good, and a little rushed.
Ending is a little rushed, or the setup is really sparse to make room. So
that's
just sort of a common thread throughout a lot of these stories. But I will say that as far as wrap up, I do really like it because I like the idea of psychology as one of Batman's
right.
tools.
Yeah.
Which I
True.
Appreciate because I think, you know, Arkham Sessions is a very,
right.
very good podcast talking about clinical mm-hmm. psychology in Batman. And I think that a lot of people who want to sort of bring a psychological lens to Batman always bring it to just Batman himself and be like, okay, well, let's talk about how messed up Bruce Wayne is as a character. Let's talk about his trauma. Let's talk about his poor coping skills. Let's talk about all this stuff. And don't sort of get that more full picture of like, yes, he's messed up, but he's also very intelligent. He is aware.
This would be one of his tools.
Like, the Bruce Wayne that we have is a Bruce Wayne who has been to therapy.
Yeah.
And I think that's a thing that gets skipped a lot mm-hmm. of times, like, that Bruce is very self-aware. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciated that in the ending, sort of putting them on the same
right.
level. His investigative skills, his butt-kicking skills, and his, like, psychological mind games
yeah.
are all tools that he can use in different situations. So
right.
that was good. I did appreciate that.
Then we get the Leslie Thompson appearance.
Yes, which I know that you appreciate for sure.
Return to Crime Alley by Denny O'Neill, a classic Batman writer, and Steve Epting. So Dr. Tompkins and Bruce have an intense meeting at the location of the murder of Bruce's parents.
Yeah. I really liked this story. Denny O'Neill, of course, is great, and anyone who ever listened to Uncovering the Bronze Age knows that I love his writing
mm-hmm.
style, like, unequivocally. This is definitely one of the ones, it doesn't feel rushed, but more
yeah.
because it doesn't feel like a complete story. It feels
right.
like a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a
slice of life.
Yeah. And it's a complete scene.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily have, like, a beginning, middle, payoff as much
right.
as, like, a full short story would.
Character sketch or something.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, it's more a character sketch or just like a small scene, which I like and I think is well dropped in to like the overall anthology nature of this book. But it does really make me want the rest of the issue. Like, I would really love to read the 26-page story breakdown that this is 8 pages
right,
of.
Right, right.
Like, it very much feels like a chunk out of a story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's well-paced. It just ends very quickly and makes me go, oh man, I I wish I could have read 14 more pages of that. I would have been really happy.
And at the end, it's really Dr. Tompkins' skills, experiences, her tools that really save the day more than Batman's skills and abilities. They have a fight and she wins.
Yes.
Basically.
And this is, again, not a criticism because the book isn't laid out chronologically.
Right.
I almost wish that this had come before the previous story to sort of have like a psychological setup and payoff between the end of this story and the end of Batman's design. Next is Heretic by Christopher Priest and Neil Adams. So we do have the O'Neill Adams team up, but they're split.
I mean, if you're going to use both of them
in the same book,
wouldn't you put them on the same story? It was weird to have O'Neill and then Adams in the next story. It's like butter spread too thinly over your, right? It's like, put them together.
Yeah.
Christopher Priest and Steve Epting. That would have worked.
That would have actually been great.
But other than that.
This is the story of the consequences from Batman's visit to Ra's al Ghul's lair all those years ago that come back and haunt him in the present.
I really like this one. It's probably because of my era, but Ra's and Talia was happening. I was reading about it when I was 7 to 12 years old, and I dig anything with those characters. That's done well. I'm looking at you, Arrow. I'm looking at you even more, Gotham. But I think in the comics, it's tend to have been handled pretty well, and I like this one. Batman turned down an offer from the Al Ghul family, and you don't just say no to them and have no consequences for the next 40-some years. Things will rebound upon you.
I really was interested in this story, but I did not like it.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like a lot of it is the fact that it came right after Return to Crime Alley. No offense to Christopher Priest. It felt very much like Christopher Priest's take on Denny O'Neill. And when you have
Denny O'Neill 8 pages before,
then it's hard to stand up to that. The two stories felt very similar to me, like starting at the sort of the street level kid off of the street, sort of low level crime,
mugging kind of story,
and dealing with those kinds of kids and the way they fit into a big, organized crime, and then talking about
true, structurally, thematically, there are some elements similar there.
And I
take it different directions, but at the core, there are similar stories.
And I almost either wish that they had collaborated, that like Return to Crime Alley and Heretic were like a part one and a part two,
right?
That were actually like plotted together. I almost feel like I really would have liked it then, because then you would have had Denny O'Neill on one and Neil Adams on the other, and then sort of have this like comprehensive story. But that's not what the book is.
Right.
And so I just have to take it based on the story itself. And it didn't quite click.
You think they did well putting it right in the middle, where you could sort of skim by it? It was surrounded by better stories, so you can sort of...
I almost wish it had been earlier.
Get it over with.
And sort of been like, okay, this is cool, but then sort of build your big hitters. Like, look, the next story is written by Brian Michael Bendis, and then Geoff Johns, Jane Tynion, and Tom King.
Right.
Just rough to put this story.
We're building up to the modern heavy hitters, yeah.
And it felt kind of off. It just didn't click for
that's
me.
That's fair.
And I wanted it to be really good. I think it was drawn by Neil Adams, but the problem was, literally all I could see was Daughter of the Dragon.
Yeah.
And then when you're comparing it to the original that it's supposed to be following up to and homaging, when it's that good...
It comes up short.
It comes up a little short.
Yeah, I get that. Well, you mentioned it. We get I Know by Brian Michael Bendis and Alex Maleev. This is a story that takes place in the future, where an elderly Penguin confronts an elderly Bruce Wayne with the knowledge that he knows he's Batman.
And he has known for decades.
And the meeting does not go as well as Oswald hoped it would.
This is probably in the top three of great stories in this issue. Like, it is another example of fantastic setup, explanation, payoff.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3. It hits all the beats and it hits them perfectly.
And it's Brian Michael Bendis. It is a lot of two people talking to each other. And it's really good.
And it's excellent. This is the kind of story that Brian Michael Bendis does well. This is, if the last story was kind of a mismatch of like story,
content, and the
content writer style,
this
not
quite that.
Working. This was the epitome. Next up is The Last Crime in Gotham, which is written by Jeff Johns with art by Kelly Jones. And it talks about, it's another future story, and it talks about what, deep, deep down, what does Batman wish for?
Yeah.
I'm going to go first and say that I really, really hated this story.
Yeah, it's...
I couldn't stand it, and I feel really bad, but I feel like a lot of that comes down to the art. The colors
strange.
Are really intense, and this is also partially just me. I got a lot of vibes of Dark Knight Strikes Again, and I hate that book so
Shut
much.
Your mouth.
So
man,
much.
Man, oh man.
That was very much what
Jeff
it
Johns
felt
and
like
Kelly
was,
Jones have unreturned books to your library? I mean, is that why you're ripping on them this much?
I don't know. I will say this for the art. There is one panel which I think is amazing, and it is a close-up zoom-in of the son of Joker.
Yeah.
And what's so unfortunate is that it does not fit in the flow of the rest of the story.
Yeah.
It is beautiful in that it is really, really awful. It hits that perfect way that a Joker should be rendered in that he is both extremely well-designed and good to look at, but when you look at him, you feel very disturbed and uncomfortable. It manages to hit that perfect type of, like, very good character design, very well executed. If that whole story had been stylized the way that that close-up, really uncomfortable shot of the Joker had been designed, I would have loved it. Because it still would have been uncomfortable, it would have been difficult to look at, but then that would have been the style. The fact that the rest of the art in this story, the other 6.5 pages, don't live up to that one panel
image,
is like, I almost wish you hadn't put the one image in there, because then I would have felt, well, the rest of this, I would have just thought of it as, well, it's just sort of mediocre and not my taste.
Not that there's one
oh,
moment.
But there's one
oh.
shining moment of the rest of it could have been this good.
I think one nice little editorial or arrangement thing, that story ends with Batman and Alfred, and the next one starts with Batman and Alfred, Bruce and Alfred.
Yes.
So this is The Precedent by James Tynion IV. Very nice fella.
He's really, really nice. I love James Tynion, and he is, in fact, one of my favorite writers. So this should be no surprise. I really liked this story.
The art was by Alvaro Martinez Bueno and Raul Fernandez. So what this one is another take, another version on the origin, well-told origin of the Batman and Robin team. So I think that story has been told about as often as we've seen Martha Wayne's Pearls Go Flying.
Yeah.
So I like this version. And it's by far the shortest thing in here. But unlike some of the things, it works. And some of the things you said about other stories where they feel like they've had to been stuffed into an 8 or 10 page format.
Mm-hmm.
This works.
And again, I feel like I'm being really mean to Jeff Johns.
You can just say nice things about Tynion, and it will be okay.
But in Last Crime in Gotham, it felt like there was a point that was trying to be made that really got lost in the writing and the pacing. Just like, it felt like there was supposed to be a point,
right.
But I left it feeling more confused than having answers.
Right.
The Precedent is only 4 pages long, 5 pages if you include a splash page.
Right. So the poster image with the last page, really.
And in those 4 pages, James Tynion manages to set up a thesis on sidekicks, and specifically on the Batman-Robin relationship, how it works, what it is, what makes it work, and sets it up in this very conversational manner with a very young Bruce Wayne talking with Alfred about what this is going to mean going forward, and then making commentary on the history of the Batman-Robin team-up and the Batman-Robin relationship as it's changed with different Robins going forward, and what that relationship has meant as like an aspect of literature, and why it's so important, and why it is so central to the Batman story, and is sort of revolutionary in superhero comics in general. And manages to make like a really good point about all of that in four pages. James Tynion is like my favorite writer basically ever, because he is extremely, extremely good at doing exactly that, at taking a concept and either elaborating on it or condensing it based on the pages or number of issues that he has. Right. In stories like this, where they are anthologies, pacing is key. And I really feel like I'm harping on all of the other writers in comparison to James Tynion, because he absolutely nailed it. He and Paul Dini. Paul Dini had more space. But the two of them really got the concept of, okay, this is how much space I have. This is how much room I have for a message. This is how much room I have for dialogue. This is how big of a thesis I can make.
Right.
And make it well.
Yeah.
Pacing is key in things like this, and he absolutely nailed it, and the art is just beautiful. Really good. It is probably my favorite art in the whole book.
I get that. Then we get Batman's Greatest Case by Tom King, Tony Daniel, and Joel Jones. So this is Team Batman, which has been a feature of the current version of Detective Comics since it came back from Rebirth, I guess, with a team that includes the Huntress and various versions of Batgirls and Batwoman. Azrael's been on the team. Clayface was on the team for a time. Gotham and Gotham Girl. They expanded the idea of Team Batman in a crazy way. And in this one, they have a family meeting on a rooftop.
As you do when you're in...
When you're Team Batman.
When you're part of the Bat fam, this is basically the kitchen table is token rooftop. That's where you do everything.
And this is one that leads to a two-page spread.
A very well-earned two-page spread.
Yep.
This is my favorite story.
It's great.
I think it's the best. There's a reason they put it last. It is very much the keystone of this issue.
Yeah. And again, it is what Detective Comics, as the comic, has been doing.
Tom King wrote a heartwarming story.
Doesn't always happen.
I really, 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 really loved the writing in this. Tom King's thing is that he is really good at character voice. And a thing that's so good about this story is that you very rarely see the speech, the speech balloon and the person in the same panel.
But doesn't matter.
But you can absolutely track who is talking at all times. This is another one of the good bait and switches. Because it's not so much that there is a twist ending.
Right.
In that your expectations are twisted on their ear because it's a Tom King story. So it's all like monotone blue, Bruce going to his parents' grave for like four pages of this story with dialogue from all the other members of the Bat fam. And so you're like, okay, it's going to be a meditation on death, and it's going to be, you know, talking about PTSD because that's Tom King's thing. And it's going to be talking about hurt and trauma because that's his thing. And it's going to be really depressing because it's Batman. And then the thesis that he ends up coming to at the end of it is beautiful and is legitimately heartwarming. Sometimes for himself and sometimes other people reading his things, Tom King's work and his focus on PTSD can be really grating or can feel shoehorned into stories where there's not really room for the commentary.
Yeah.
This is not one of those.
Right.
This is a chance where he really gets to be a little bit more expansive instead of just talking about the hurt and the pain.
Right.
But he can sort of talk about the other side of PTSD that he doesn't really get asked to talk about very often, which is the healing process.
Right.
And the scars that influence your behavior going forward, but that it does not have to define you. It does not have to calcify around you. It doesn't have to stop you from growing.
Neither of us has read Mr. Miracle, have we?
No.
His Mr. Miracle.
I really want to, though.
I read his Vision. That was quite good. And despite what I've heard, I'm probably going to read Heroes in Crisis, too. I know that might be pushing it, but I tend to appreciate, not always like, I tend to appreciate what King does.
Exactly. He's very good at what he does.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm going to put at least half of the blame for these sorts of things on editors. Either editors asking him to write
right.
a specific type of story or asking him onto a series knowing
right.
the types of stories that he writes.
Mm-hmm. You're the guy for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're the PTSD guy. You're the war guy. You're the, yeah.
Yeah, and then being sort of upset that that is the type of story that he writes,
yeah,
it's sort
exactly.
of like, okay,
yeah.
well, this is his thing.
Yeah.
I get,
you hired him because it's his thing.
Why did you invite Kevin Smith if you didn't want him
exactly.
to be kind of irreverent,
yeah.
postmodern, and self-effacing? Like,
yeah.
that's his thing. Why would you have him write Superman if you didn't want him to write this type of Superman
right.
story, for example? So, yeah, Batman's Greatest Case, I think it is probably tied with The Precedent and with Mr. Deeney's Legend of New Grody.
As your favorites.
As like
yeah.
the my favorite
yeah.
three. Like,
now you called this one the last story, and it's the last of the celebration stories. There are a couple of pinups after this, which I think is nice because that sort of separates it.
Mm-hmm.
The very last story, we just mentioned Medieval. By Peter Tomasi, Doug Mankey, and Jaime Mendoza. And that's just really leading into the next story arc. Doesn't really fit, I think, the celebratory aspect
okay.
of what we're doing here. So
here's another thing of me telling editors how to do their job. I did not like that this was included.
I liked that it was sort of an epilogue. Because you had the last story. You had pinups. It felt like this is... It's like the bonus guy. I'm trying to help them. But I agree with you. It's a shame it was here.
And I will say this.
You could have taken those 8 pages and given 2.
You could have given 2 more to Denny O'Neill. You could have
given 2 to... Yeah, I 2
given
two
one
to John.
More to Warren
give another
Ellis.
I know. Yes. And then 2 more pinups would have been fine, too.
Know, or even if you wanted to have 2 or 3 pages of, like, and Arkham Knight is coming, or be like, you know, again, not to tell... creative director teams at DC Comics what to do, but also we're fans and we read this, so that's kind of our job. Like, do 2 all black pages or very simplistic
right.
pages that are just sort of commentary and be like, ooh, what's coming up next?
Right.
Ooh, what is this? Ooh, and then you just turn it over and it's the Arkham Knight villain.
See, the way
like
I,
the final splash page, like,
the
oh,
way,
wow, that's cool.
The way I was able to justify it is there are no ads in the book. I counted that as an 8-page house ad.
Okay.
I didn't count it as a story.
That's
think of it that way.
That is a fair way to think about it.
Think
it is,
of it as an 8-page house ad. You don't have to read it, then you're done.
That's true. That is very true. I do wish that it had been 2 or 3 pages shorter, or that
yeah,
they had cut
I
out
gotcha.
The pinups.
I get you.
Because
there were stories that could have used those pages.
Man, like Return to Crime Alley could have been a lot better if there was one more page. If there was one more page to have like
you know,
Leslie and Bruce
yeah,
sit
yeah.
down. Last Crime in Gotham. I
yep.
didn't like it, but it could have been a lot less confusing with, like, 3 more pages. You know? Give Batman's design a little more space to breathe. Give Heretic an extra page and a half
okay,
so that the opening isn't so rushed.
Let's stop complaining. This is an anniversary celebration.
It is.
Of them and of us.
Yeah.
So let's end on the let's end on the positive. Let's end on the James Tynion in the 4th. Nice guy.
Very nice guy and a very good
nice
writer.
Nice writer. I don't know that I mentioned it in particular, but the rooftop, Batman's Greatest Case, Bathound is there also. So
of course, yeah.
If you
no
start
one...
with Bobo and end with Bathound, I don't care what the other 86 pages are. It's probably pretty good.
Exactly. I for all of my criticisms, the reason I criticize... because I really liked this.
It's pretty good. I think it's pretty good.
You know, I wanted it to be great, but it was still really good.
Yeah.
I said earlier, I will gladly pay $7 for my own copy of this. And that's a
mm-hmm.
pretty big endorsement
yeah,
from the two
yeah,
of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I really did actually like this issue. I think it made a lot of interesting points, and I think it was a really awesome celebration of what Batman has been and could be and is to a variety of different people. And it was, gonna be honest... kind of a fruit salad.
Yep, that there you go.
But that's not a bad thing. It was good.
Now, we're not going to cover Marvel Comics 1000.
No.
Mostly because They're just making that up.
Yeah, that's just...
That's a what-if story. That's a if we'd published a comic with this title monthly for this many years since we started, it would now be.
Yeah, it's...
I'm calling you on that one.
That's marketing and we're not buying it.
Now Detective in Action, they did have their renumberings for the New 52, but they...
They earned it.
Each had a thousand issues. I appreciate that part of it. And I did check on the DCU app, and Detective Comics 1 through 26 are not there. I'd be interested. Kind of curious what happened. I believe Mike Voyles, when he was doing his DC History show, I think he had gotten into the early pre-Batman Detective Comics. Those intrigue me. Because even though it's 1,000, again, to give credit to the Superman fans, that was... Superman was not necessarily in every when it went Action Comics weekly. So okay, I'm trying to anticipate. You know, neither character was fully represented in all 1,000, but come on.
Yeah.
We can celebrate. We can celebrate equally our two preeminent DC Comics heroes.
Absolutely. And we would also like to thank all of you lovely listeners for listening through this rambling episode and the 65 episodes that preceded it.
Whether you've been with us for all 6 years or just from like that Doctor Who episode when we went to Gallifrey 1.
However you found us, we're glad you found us and we appreciate your listening.
Yeah. And if you have something to share with us, comments about this episode or, and you know we really mean this,
any prior episodes.
We would love to hear from you. You can do that via email at relativelygeeky@gmail.com.
Or you can leave a comment on this episode posting on relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
And when it comes to anything we've ever talked about on any episode over the last 6 years or will talk about on an episode in the upcoming X number of years, always remember this. We're not experts.
We're just family.